One journey I had in the winter time was to go to pick up goods at a place called Economy, which was at the mouth of the Dwina River, where an icebreaker was coming in from Murmansk with a consignment of blankets. I had to take down about 20 sleighs, with their own Russian drivers, of course, wait for this icebreaker, then when the barrels of blankets were unloaded, they were from the steamer, they were loaded onto the sleigh and sleighs and brought over to Bakarutsa. Quite a journey, must have been 10 to 12 miles each way. However, an interesting thing is, whilst we were waiting for the icebreaker to arrive, we were watching other things happening. The river was frozen over, but periodically some icebreaker would come up the river. The principle of an icebreaker being not that it pushes through the ice by sheer force, but the bow is so constructed that it rides over the ice, and then the weight of the vessel cracks the ice. The ship then goes into reverse and takes a charge, and it goes through the ice that it's broken and repeats the operation time and time again. The ice, of course, is not destroyed, but merely broken, and comes back into the channel that has been cleared by the ship. And on this occasion, the ice that had been broken had knit together again in about a quarter of an hour or 20 minutes, and horses and sleighs were passing over it again. So you may tell how cold it was. Another interesting thing was that at the Bakarutsa end of Archangel, I think it was called Smolny, there was a railway line run down to the river's edge, and again at the Bakarutsa side, that is at the other side of the river, similarly a railway line was run down to the river edge, and then when the ice got thick, sleepers were laid across the ice, holes were made in the ice, and water was pumped up so as to freeze the sleepers to the ice, and then railway lines were spiked onto the sleepers, and although the river at that point must have been the better part of a mile wide, the wagons from the Archangel, the Smolny end, were pushed, let go down the slope with a good push, and that made them run across the river for a considerable distance, and then a tow rope was brought down at the Bakarutsa side, hooked onto the wagon hook, and they were hauled up at the other side. Naturally, it was not strong enough to support a railway engine, but it was strong enough to support 4 or 5 wagons at a time. So it gives you some idea of the degree of frost. One of the so-called adventures that we had, something to break up the humdrum, was to convoy goods up the line. There was a railway line from Bakarutsa to Vologda and then down to St. Petersburg. Of course, we had not got control of this line all the way. We only went up to a place where there was no real village, 2 or 3 cottages, and this place was known as Verse 865, I think it was. The name doesn't matter, but a verst is the Russian equivalent of a kilometer, and the distances were marked off in the number of versts from a major point, in this case from Vologda, and that was the point. The locomotives were great big things, but there was no coal. It was all logs of wood that was the fuel. However, I got myself on one of these convoys and at the same time got a sleeping bag to sleep in during the night. One wasn't expected to keep awake all night guarding the trucks. Once the trucks were on the move, you could get down to sleep. I made a cubby hole in the back of a truck on some bales where I could put my sleeping bag and have a good sleep. But it was appallingly cold all night. I couldn't understand why my sleeping bag was no good. In fact, after we got to a sort of halfway stage, I got down from my truck, went to the engine where they were restocking with logs of wood, and I spent the rest of the journey in the railway engine cab, sitting at one side of the boiler. When I eventually got to my destination and delivered over my goods, I had made an examination of my sleeping bag, which was a fur inside, somewhat after the nature of the fur jackets that are now worn, with a canvas outer bag, and I found that the fur had not been properly sewn together. That is, there was a leakage in it letting in the cold air. Consequently, that was why I couldn't get warm all night. Another thing was, don't sleep with your boots on. It's too cold. Take your boots off. It's much warmer. Shortly after the new year, I was put on a job away from Bakaritsa to supply a force which was making some attack on the Bolsheviks. And this meant going to a place called Piniga, which was some, I suppose, 150 miles to the east of Archangel. First of all, we left Archangel, possibly a dozen men, in six or eight sleighs, along with a quantity of supplies, and there was little or no road. The main method of travelling was keep to the river bank, or just on the edge of the river. But when we came to a village about halfway and felt it was time for something to eat, we went to the house of the Zemsta. I don't know whether he was the posting master or the mayor or what he was, but however, you went to the Zemsta and you said to him that you wanted horses immediately. What we actually said was loshet, which is horses, and sichas, which means, I don't know what it means, we used it as immediately. If you said, what hour is it? You said, skulka, which is how many? Chas, skulka chas. So that it might mean horses within the hour. If you got them within the hour, you were very lucky. But in any case, what we did, the horses we had to return to Bakaritsa. We offloaded and wanted fresh horses as soon as he could get them. In the meantime, we went into the house of the Zemsta, and his wife, very kindly and apparently according to custom, Now the Russians at that time couldn't get tea, and like everything else, they were under famine conditions. Consequently, our best way of paying for anything was with such like. Now, Madam of the house provided us with tea, and very kindly, in accordance with, we would have drunk our tea out of our mess tins, but she, in accordance with Russian custom, provided us with glass tumblers. Now, the Russians heat their water in a sort of a tea urn with a central tube for charcoal, which is called a samovar, and they make a little strong tea in a teapot. Pour this into the glass, like a tot of whiskey, more or less, and then fill up with hot water from the samovar. This was what we did, and in doing this, one of the fellows let the teapot lid fall into his tumbler, which splintered and broke. It was pure Woolworth quality, and by our standards, not worth worrying about. Nevertheless, he apologized to the Russian woman and offered to pay her. First of all, he would give her a couple of rubles, which were worth sixpence each, that is a shilling. But she said, "Nedobre, no good." So he said, "Well, 10 rubles, 5 shillings, nedobre." He eventually offered her up to, I think it was 20 rubles, still nedobre. So he said, "Well, what the dickens am I to do about this?" The trouble with it was, of course, that the glass, poor as it was, could not be replaced. So somebody said, "Oh, give her some tea and sugar." We carried tea and sugar all mixed up together in a sandbag, with tins of bully beef and bread and the whole lot in the one sack. The upshot of it was, we gave the good lady a handful of mixed tea and sugar and a couple of tins of bully beef, and I think we could have broken all the cups in the house. So, as it may seem, but simply on a question of supply and demand. However, I'm making a long story of this. We got our sleighs and went on to, I think the place was called Kolnogory, where I left the main party. I was there for a couple or 3 days. At that time, we did a little bit of skiing on a hillside, when we'd got nothing else to do. That was the only occasion that I did any skiing. And then I left alone, that is, without any other Britishers with me, to go to Pinniga, which was a two-day journey, I think. Having just the sleigh driver and myself, these were not the same type of sleigh, but of course it was not heavily laden, consequently the horse could go at a trot, and we went a matter of about 10 to 12 versts, and then went to the Zemster at the respective village, told him we wanted Lossat Sichas. The sleigh that I had returned to the place it had come from, and I got a fresh sleigh, staging perhaps 3 or 4 sleighs a day. This was quite interesting because I got to know different people, and although I couldn't speak a lot of Russian, I could just do a little bit. For example, on one journey, I had a little boy with me. He was only quite a little boy, he couldn't have been more than 12 or 13, and we were going through forestry, and we could hear what sounded like dogs barking. I asked him, were they dogs? The Russian word for dog is sabaka, and he said no. So the only conclusion I could come to were that they were wolves. Whatever it was, I don't know. But we got to our village of destination, where I was going to stay the night. I asked this kiddie to stay there, but fortunately there was another boy from his own village who was waiting for a companion, and the two of them went back together. I think that possibly here I should try to give some description of what the Russian houses are like. Some were frame buildings lined inside and outside with what one might call thick floorboards, and the interior of the frame was stuffed with sawdust, which apparently was quite a good insulation. But the bulk of the village houses were just the tree trunks flattened on one side, the corners where the end joined the side was dovetailed so that it fitted with the piece going in the, at right angles, and laid one on top of the other, and between the log was tow or jute or something like coconut fibre matting material to seal. I don't remember whether they were plastered inside or just what they were like. However, that doesn't very much matter. There were one-story houses with possibly chickens and that sort of thing up in the apex of the roof. There were usually a couple of rooms only, one of which was the principal room of the house, dining room, kitchen, bedroom, everything. The stove was a brick-built affair, which would be about 6 feet or more long and 4 or 5 feet wide, the cooking arrangements being in a box, as it were, at the normal cooking height, and over this was a canopy on which beds were made, and I don't know how many of the family slept on it, as many as possible, I suppose. Obviously, it was necessary and desirable and necessary to sleep where the utmost heat could be obtained. So far as we travellers were concerned, we didn't ask permission to stay the night, as far as I remember. We just took our gear inside, and it was taken for granted that we would do. In this particular house, they were very pleasant people, having, as far as I remember, 2 or 3 young children. Madam let me get at the stove to make myself a meal, and they were greatly intrigued. I had a can of sausages, and after I had eaten what I wanted, I gave the rest of the sausages to the children. I don't think they had ever seen them before, and they certainly relished them. There was no question of fear of sleeping in the house. They just took it for granted that they were all right, and nothing ever happened. One thing I should... opposite the door of the entrance room, there was usually an icon. Not an icon such as is seen in the churches and so on, but a bit of a tin thing, probably made in Birmingham, tin plate, painted, and as the first thing when people entered the room in the morning, they bowed to the icon, crossed themselves, and said, Drastogy. I don't know whether Drastogy meant God be with you, bless this house, or what it was. But it was also used as a greeting when you met people in the road in the morning. They would greet you in the morning with Dobre utrum, good morning, Dobre vecherum, good afternoon, or Dobre nich, good night. The family with which I stayed the night that I was talking about previously were quite a decent crowd. I don't remember much detail about them, but the next morning, as they were harnessing up the sleigh for the next stage of the journey, the young boy of the family, about 10 to 12, was to be the izvoshchik, the sleigh driver, and whilst the harnessing was going on, I offered the father a cigarette, which he was very glad to accept, also offered one to the little boy. But father said, no, he doesn't smoke. We then got away, and after we were half a mile or more from the village, the little boy said to me, English, dighty cigarette. All the kiddies smoked when they could get them, which was not very often, I suppose, because cigarettes, like everything else, was at a premium. Whilst I'm mentioning harnessing the sleigh, I might mention that this was rather interesting. If you see pictures of Russian horses, there is a sort of a hoop over the end of the shafts. This is a wooden arrangement. The horse's collar is hinged at the top and open at the bottom, not like an English horse's collar. It's put over the head, And then attached to the side of the collar are, at either side, rawhide thongs, rawhide loops, about, I suppose, 18 inches long. The loop is put over the top of the shaft and then underneath, and on the inside of the shaft, of either shaft, is this hoop over the horse's head, and the end of the loop attached to the collar is put over the end of the hoop so as to make a tight job of it. Then at the bottom of the collar is another lashing which is wrapped round and round, drawing the collar together and making the whole thing tight. Therefore the cart or sleigh is drawn simply by the pressure of the horse's shoulders on the collar, and thus I can't remember much about the rest of this journey, but I seem to recall that it was here that I changed horses again at Zemster's, where they had a new baby, only a matter of a few days old, and they were very proud to show off this child to the Englishman. They also had a little girl, I don't know, she might have been 7 or 8, but she was a lovely little child and looked delightful in fur jacket. They were more like a nightie covering them from the neck to almost the feet, and then a fur hat, both being snow white. Whether they were fox fur, rabbit fur, or what they were, I don't know, but she did really look most charming. Needless to say, they got some grub from me when I had my meal. Also the kiddies got sundry bars of chocolate and so on. I don't think I've mentioned about this tea drinking. Tea was almost unobtainable to the Russians, and so what we did after we had had a drink of tea with our meal was to pass the teapot with the tea leaves over to the lady of the house, or if we had a number of sleigh drivers with us, pass it over to them, and they would drink tea, as I've already said, by putting a tot into a glass and filling up with water, as much as a dozen cups, a dozen glasses each. Also, the sugar they had was not like we have, but more like sugar candy, and they broke it from a big piece with something in the nature of pliers or nutcrackers, and then held the sugar in the teeth and drank the tea through the teeth. You could hear every drop of it. I reached Pinniger on the afternoon of this day and had a letter of introduction to the Army Service Corps Sergeant Major. He told me that he had with him a couple of privates as doing the work of the job, and those were the only three Englishmen in Pinniger, although there were perhaps 100 or more Americans. I spent the evening with him in the canteen or something of the sort, and then slept on the floor of his bedroom for that night. But during our evening, he mentioned that one of his men had married a Russian girl. Much to my surprise, on walking up the yard of the place where the Army Service Corps had their depot and I was to get a place, I met a boy from Coon, Billy Hoyle. He recognized me, as we had known one another, and he said, "Did you know that I was married?" I said, "No, I didn't know you were, but this Army but your Sergeant Major had said that there was a damn fool had married a Russian girl," so that was my introduction to him in Russia. Ultimately, I got a billet in the same house as him, and subsequently two other fellows came up to join me to run the ordnance depot. Our job there being to supply the Russians with whatever they required in the way of uniform, etc., I had to receive it up from base and then dole it out as required. Daily, I had to make a visit to the Russian commandant's office and see, I don't know what he was, a captain or something of the sort of the Russian unit there. And the first thing after we had greeted one another with Drastogy and Dobro Vechern, the Russian would say, English, dirty cigarette. They were a nation of scroungers, but of course one can understand, the poor folks just didn't have anything. So it's not unreasonable. I was in Pinniger for perhaps a couple of months or more. I don't remember exactly how long, but there's nothing very spectacular happened. We got lousy, that's one thing I do remember, and found that the only way we could get rid of these troubles were to hang our shirts on the line for a fortnight. Hanging them out in the frost for a week seemed to have no effect, as presumably the eggs were not affected by the cold, and consequently you put your shirt on the seventh day, and on the eighth day out hatch the eggs. But put the shirt out for a fortnight after washing, and you haven't any further trouble. So that was one thing discovered. I don't think I've mentioned a Russian bath, or banya as they call it. This is after the nature of a Turkish bath. There are several rooms in the bath, which of course is a wooden log structure. In this, the Pinniger affair was a somewhat elementary one, but down at Bakaritsa was much bigger. I'll talk about the Bakaritsa one. It was a big room, a big building divided into several rooms. The first room had a series of benches on which one could undress, and it was almighty warm as you were undressing. You then went into the bathroom, which was hotter still, steam heated and hot water, washing and throwing water over oneself and so on, and then you could go into a third room, which was again hotter, and this had a monkey rack arrangement on which you could climb stairs, and when you sat on the top of this monkey rack, it was almost enough to blister you with the heat. Naturally, you came down bit by bit and went out first into one room and cool off, and then into another. But the funny thing is that in going down again, each room that you came to seemed very cold after what you had been in. What one had to guard against was not getting cold after going out of the bath place.